Okay.
Excellent.
Thank you. Okay, so let's get started on the questions for tonight. There's quite a lot here, so that's good. So let's see what happens. Ajahn, if we take the Gatikara Sutta at its words, the Buddha-to-be was a once-returner in the final birth, does it then follow that right view is already established in them? The Gatikara Sutta doesn't say that the Buddha was a once-returner. That is a kind of inference that is made sometimes, but doesn't actually say that. It just says that the Buddha was the present Buddha was a disciple under the previous Buddha. That's really all it says. It doesn't say anything about the results of that. Some people say that if the present Buddha was a disciple under the past Buddha, you would expect him to be at least a stream enter or once returner. But actually, there's no direct evidence for that. So, it's kind of hard to really say what is going on there. I think this is Ajahn Brahm's kind of favorite little thesis, that this is the case. But whether that actually is right or not is probably a little bit controversial. But of course, if the Buddha did have right view from a past life, then he certainly would have a very big advantage and make it much easier to become a Buddha in the present life. But difficult to know exactly what happened there, because not stated explicitly here. All right. Hi, Ajahn. What is the title of the book you mentioned this afternoon about the near-death experiences? Thank you. That book is called After. Yeah, very short title, After, A-F-T-E-R. And it is by a fellow called Bruce Grayson, who is a professor he was a professor at the University of Virginia, one of the top universities in the U.S., and they actually had a department of, they called it Department of Perceptual Studies, and it's really about all these kind of exceptional phenomena, etc. And his area of expertise was actually near-death experiences. He spent his whole life studying this phenomena, and obviously from a scientific point of view, and that's what makes it very interesting. So After is the name of the book, and the author is called Bruce Grayson. Okay, so next one. How does a stream enter realize and know this in the subsequent lives after realizing, experiencing this? Don't know. That is a short answer. It doesn't say anywhere in the suttas what happens. All the suttas say is that if you become a stream enter, then you will become a fully enlightened person within 7 lifetimes at the most. It doesn't even say that you have to know this. It is not actually a requirement to know these things. So whether you actually know it or not, even that is actually uncertain. But the idea is that because you have right view, it means that your mind will kind of naturally incline in the right direction. If you are a stream enter, you have seen the Dhamma, you know where suffering is to be found, you know where happiness is to be found, so your mind will tend to incline in the right direction. And this is kind of the idea of right view. And whether you re-experience that right view in this life or not, whether that really is required, that also is actually uncertain. It is not clear that that actually is required. So it may just be that imprint in the mind from the past life is so strong that you automatically incline in the right way. Something like that. Many of these questions are, there is no definitive answer to many of these questions. Okay, let's go on to the next one. In your own practice, what stage did you find the most challenging and difficult? Kindest regards. Most difficult part is always the beginning of practice. As you start to kind of get a bit more stable in your practice. It becomes easier. It's the beginning is always the hardest part, because in the beginning you are still kind of struggling maybe to have right view, to accept certain things of the Dhamma, to really try to understand what the Buddha really was teaching, and you're kind of struggling, kind of flailing a little bit to find the path for yourself. So the beginning is always the most difficult, and then as the practice continues, and as some of the worst defilements are kind of overcome, then the mind stabilizes a bit more, and it's actually easier to practice. And once the mind starts to, you know, enjoy the meditation, etc., actually becomes a lot easier, because then you are actually enjoying yourself. You have a kind of that spiritual nourishment that comes through the meditation practice. Before that, when there is lacking in that spiritual nourishment, you are still struggling, because you kind of have one leg in the sensual world and one leg in the spiritual world, and you're not really able to kind of fully move from one to the other. The more you move into the spiritual world, the more you can let go of the sensual world, and the easier it is to be a monastic or, you know, whatever you want on the spiritual practice. So the further you go along, the easier it is. And this is kind of the beauty of this path, that actually the beginning is really the hard part. But the beginning is also interesting, because the beginning is where you learn, is when you investigate the Dhamma, is where you feel a kind of a significant growth from the beginning. So the beginning is also interesting, even though sometimes the struggle can be difficult, because you're trying to understand, you're trying to overcome problems, etc. All right. Dear Ajahn, when we say see the danger in the slightest fault, is this just in regard to the training rules, or seeing the danger in even a bad thought, etc.? Thank you. Seeing the danger in the slightest fault, annumatesu vajesu bayadassavi, is one of those standard phrases that you find in the suttas. And the idea there is not just the training rules, but actually the entire practice. I think that's quite obvious, because if it's just the training rules aren't really that significant always. Some of them are quite minor, some of them may not really matter as far as morality is concerned. Not everything in the monastic rules is about morality. Some of it is about customs and habits and what is polite, etc. But the morality aspect obviously matters for your ability to meditate and make progress on the path. So that, I think, is what is meant by seeing danger in the slightest fault. So not really allowing the mind to dwell in unwholesome ways, not thinking that doesn't matter, not allowing remnants of bad speech or right actions to allow that to persist in you, but overcome these things, understanding that they actually matter. You're holding yourself back if you allow even little things to remain, because you are maybe not motivated or whatever to overcome it, or you think it doesn't matter, etc. Actually, it does matter enormously. The idea is that if you really purify your virtue, your morality, meditation is automatic. So if your meditation is not automatic, if you don't find natural joy, natural happiness, natural peace in the meditation, it means that there's something more to be done at the very beginning, which is the path of virtue and kindness and morality. That is where the problem always lies. Coming back to morality all the time. So how pure is your mind? What kind of mental states do you normally have? Do you have a sense of compassion, kindness for the people around you? Or do you get upset sometimes? And that is where kind of the difference is between good meditation and bad meditation. So seeing the tiny things can sometimes be obstacles in this practice. And that is what I think is the meaning of this. All right. If someone asks us what is right view, what would be a simple and succinct response to this question? So the succinct and the simple response would be to know the difference between happiness and suffering. Yeah, in the deeper sense of the word, not just kind of the worldly happiness and worldly suffering, but having a proper understanding of where happiness truly is found and where suffering is truly to be found. That is the idea of right view. So, for example, if you look at the Four Noble Truths, yeah, understanding the Four Noble Truths is often considered a right view in Buddhism. And the Four Noble Truths, they start with dukkha, with suffering. Yeah, so it's about having an insight into suffering, where suffering is to be found. Of course, if you understand suffering, you also understand happiness, because this is just the opposite side of the coin. So that is really the answer, I would say, to that one. Understanding happiness and suffering in the deepest, the full meaning of these words. The kind of the Buddhist outlook when it comes to these things. All right. This is going very fast. That's kind of good news. Bhante, how are these different habits, anusaya, kilesa, sankaras, and kamas? Okay, so how are these different? Sankaras is usually just another word for intention, right? If you have the way that sankaras are defined in the suttas, it is defined as sanchetana. Chetana is always intention, and sankara is defined in this way in the sutta. So when we talk about the five khandas, the five aggregates, we have rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, and vijnana, form, feelings, perceptions, will and consciousness. When you have those five, the fourth one, sankara, right there, is the will or intention, if you like. Now, intentions in Buddhism, they have a moral significance. So when you intend something, you can either intend something coming from a good place within you or from a bad place within you. You can intend something with anger, with desire, or you can intend something with generosity or kindness. And that gives the intention moral value. It is what motivates and drives that intention that gives it moral value. And that is when you make kamma. Yeah, kamma is intention together with the motivation that drives that intention, and that causes kamma. So kamma is the type of intention that you are having. Now that intention can be bad, right? It can become from bad motivations, and these bad motivations, they are kilesas. These are defilements. Kilesa means defilement. In the suttas, it is also sometimes called a sankilesa or upakilesa, like refined defilements or corruptions of the mind. So when the mind is corrupted and you act, your intentions are based on those corruptions, you are making bad kamma as a consequence. If you have corruptions of the mind, but you don't act on them, and you act on some other beautiful quality of the mind, then you're making good kamma instead. So kilesas are the things that color the intentions. They color the intentions in a bad way. And when you act on those colored intentions, you make bad kamma as a consequence. This is how these things fit together here. Anusaya in the Pali is like an underlying tendency. And the idea here is that even though you may not be greedy at one particular time, the underlying tendency, the tendency to greed is still there. It is just waiting to manifest. It is not always present in the mind, but it may manifest at any time. And that is the idea of underlying tendencies. So in Buddhism, you're not free of the kilesas until the underlying tendency is eradicated. So the idea is that you reduce the kilesas, you reduce the defilements of the mind. By reducing the defilements of the mind, you can enter a state of samadhi. And after the state of samadhi, you can eliminate the underlying tendencies. So first of all, you have a temporary elimination of defilements that allows you to attain samadhi. And through that samadhi, you can kind of eliminate the defilements completely, which includes the anusayas, the underlying tendencies. And habits, well, habits are just the tendency of the mind. The mind tends to have a certain way of dealing with things. When you meet certain people, you may feel happy. When you meet other people, you may feel maybe get upset maybe with certain people. Other people may make you feel, I don't know what, some kind of emotions. So the habits of the mind are the habits of how we tend to react to things in the world. And we tend to react to certain things with greed, to other things with ill will, to some things with generosity, to some things with kindness, depending on the input that we get around us. And so our job is to change our habits. And this is why it is so difficult to practice the spiritual path, because habits can be very strong. They have a lot of momentum from the past. So it's difficult to change our habits. But this is one of the very important things on the path, what we are trying to do. So the tendency of the mind is different. Instead of tending towards ill will, tending towards greed, we tend towards compassion, we tend towards metta, we tend towards understanding, towards generosity. Gradually, you change the direction of the mind. The habits become different. And after a while, you are compassionate to other people. You don't have so much ill will anymore. Why? Because you understand that everyone is really a victim of their habits, victim of the past conditioning. If someone is a victim of the past conditioning, how can you get angry with them? It doesn't make any sense. You have to have compassion for them. And everyone in the world is a victim of their past conditioning. So really, the answer is having compassion for everyone. And then rejoicing in those people who are good people, who actually have lots of good qualities. And when you have that combination of metta and compassion, you have a very powerful, built up some very powerful mental qualities that usually will allow the meditation to happen. This is kind of the idea of habits here. So habits and anusaya, are they the same thing? In a sense, they are very closely related to each other, because the anusaya is the underlying tendency, and habit is also like an underlying tendency, because it tends to come back again and again. There is a similarity there, but anusaya tends to focus on those underlying tendencies that are bad qualities rather than positive qualities. Habits is a bit more broader. So I'm not sure if that was what you were asking, but anyways, this is roughly the meaning of these terms in the Pali language and how they kind of operate together, if you like. All right. Dear Venerable Ajahn, thank you very much for the great explanation of the first two suttas. What a marvelous start to the retreat, Ajahn. Well, this is kind of very positive, isn't it? Very nice to hear this. In Sanghita Nikaya 1.1, would you say, Ajahn, not standing still could be interpreted as appamada? Not striving as samadhi. Thank you, Ajahn. So not standing still. So standing still means that you don't do anything, and that could be pamada. Pamada means being negligent. Apamada means the opposite. It means like being heedful or careful or circumspect or something like that. So I would tend to agree that that is probably very close to the truth. Because if you don't do anything, if you don't understand that there is a problem, basically you are negligent. You're not really looking at the world properly. You're not understanding the problems in life. You're not understanding that there is something to be overcome. And then, of course, the problems just keep on coming, and they often get worse as a consequence. And not striving is samadhi. I think the higher kind of not striving is samadhi, because when you enter a state of samadhi, the will is completely gone, the craving, the desire is completely gone, so there certainly is no striving there. But I think also the general practice is about not really striving, but using wisdom instead. So it is true that samadhi is kind of maybe the highest manifestation of not striving. But even before that, we don't want to strive in the sense of pushing ourselves, using too much willpower, but trying to use wisdom instead on the path. The more we use wisdom, the less striving there is. There's just like an inclination of the mind, trying to understand, trying to use the wisdom that we have. Yeah, just leaning the mind in the right direction is really what it is about. So you establish right view by reading the suttas, by contemplating what the Buddha is talking about, and then you apply that right view. And when you apply it, that is where you overcome the problems in the mind, by because you understand things in the right way. But yes, samadhi is kind of the highest expression of that. I would agree with that. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you for reminding me I'm going to die. Okay. Good. I'm glad I did remind you of that one, because that's important. Also, big thanks to Leha, Christina and team for their awesome work. When the Buddha said, "Neither halting nor straining, sir, I crossed the flood, are there any parallels that can be drawn between this statement and the middle way, Noble Eightfold Path? Is willpower one of the extremes? Many thanks." Is willpower one of the extremes? I think it can be understood that way, because if you are practicing the kind of tormenting of the body, also they call the Atakilamatanu Yoga, which is often translated as self-mortification, but it's kind of a very old-fashioned way of talking about things, more like tormenting yourself might be a better way of putting it. Often it includes willpower, because you are doing something that is very painful, and it actually requires a degree of willpower to sustain that. And so that is one way of thinking about it. I think that is not entirely wrong. On the other hand, if you just allow yourself to indulge in sensual pleasures, it doesn't take much willpower, kind of just following your natural inclinations. That, I would say, is more like halting. You're just stopping. You're no longer really doing anything to cross the stream. You're just kind of enjoying whatever is there, not actually doing anything. So that might be a way of thinking about the middle way, that you are halting by enjoying the sensual pleasures and then striving by doing the self-tormenting of the bodies. I think that is an interesting approach. And then the middle way is the middle way that starts with right view. So once you have that right view, you don't really have to strive. The stronger that right view is, the natural expression of that right view is to practice the Noble Eightfold Path. It just happens as a matter of course once right view is established. So I think there is some truth to that. I think that is an interesting way of putting it. So that's kind of, so I think you probably have a point there. So thank you for that. And all right, so did the Buddha give examples of how to be more generous? If no, can you suggest and give some examples? I feel in today's world generosity is linked to how much money you can give to charities and people, etc. I feel guilty if I say no. I do support and donate where I can, but I too need money to pay bills, etc. And I can't give it all away. I'm concerned of rebirth in hungry ghost realm as I said no. So generosity is more like an inclination of the heart, an inclination of the mind. So it is really how you feel more than, sometimes you can't do it. And whether if you can't do it, you can't. You have to look after yourself. You have to make sure that you are okay. The Buddha says that when you have material possessions, the first person you should look after is yourself. It's kind of interesting. In Buddhism, looking after oneself is actually very important. And then the second people you should look after yourself are your family members. Your spouse, your children, etc. And then the broader family. And then maybe people who you, in the Sutta, they talk about employees. Maybe you haven't got any employees, but maybe people in the kind of your larger circle of friends. And then it talks about also supporting monastics, samanas, they talk about in the suttas. So you do what you can. You know what is kind of the right amount, right? And the right way of being generous. But generosity is very often also just a mental, it's an attitude. And sometimes you can be generous in very simple ways. There is no very clear distinction between generosity and morality, because positive morality, treating other people well, is also a kind of generosity. How do you speak to other people? I talked the other day, or yesterday, or this morning, whenever it was, about the idea of being silent. And silence can be an act of generosity to the people around you. You're giving them peace. You're giving them the ability to calm down without interference. That is a kind of generosity. Generosity comes in so many different ways. It's really about how you treat other people. If you keep the five precepts, you're giving people often the freedom from fear. If people know that you're going to be kind to them, you're not going to steal, you're not going to take advantage of them in any particular way, that means you're giving people that freedom from fear and anxiety. Isn't that a beautiful gift to give in the world? So all of these things are just different ways of being generous and being kind. In the sutta, as one of the examples of generosity, it says for the monastics, if you are washing your bowl and you have some scraps left in your bowl, like a few grains of rice or whatever, when you pour that out on the ground, all you have to do is to have the intention. May the little beings, the little insects in the ground, may they enjoy these scraps of food. And already you're making good karma. You're already being generous. It's very simple to be generous. So generosity is more like a state of mind. It's more like where you're coming from when you're dealing with other people. Do you want to be kind to them? Do you want to give them the gift of kind speech? You know what it's like when someone speaks to you in a kind way, when you feel that they have your kind of happiness at heart when they speak or whatever, when they speak gently, when they speak meaningfully. It feels really nice when people behave in that way towards you. So almost anything can be an act of generosity in this world. So yes, giving material things or giving money or whatever, that's part of it. But it's really only one part of a much broader kind of thing. So you try to sort of find ways of doing this without hurting yourself or doing something that leads to a problem. So that is really the right way of thinking about this. There's a nice little sutta that I in the Sanghita Nikaya that talks about the idea of generosity, and it says something to the effect of when a house is burning, it is the pot that is removed from the house that is of use. So if your house is burning down, if the pot that you have is still sitting in the house, when the house burns down, the pot will melt and it won't be useful anymore. But it's the pot that is taken out of the house that is still useful. In the same way, life is like on fire. It is all on fire. It is all deteriorating, all kind of heading towards destruction in one way or another. And the pot that is removed from the house is similar to the wealth that you use in a good way while you are alive. If you put your wealth to good use, in the sense of supporting whatever is anyone who is kind of needy or whatever, you use it in a good way to make merit or, whatever way, that is the money that is salvaged. It is used in a good way. It's like the pot that is taken out of the house because you have used it in a good way while you're still living here. It's a kind of a nice simile right there. There's all this kind of awesome similes in the suttas and they kind of give you an idea of how to live your life. So that's kind of one of them. Anyway, so I hope that makes things a bit more clear here. Okay, dear Ajahn, you mentioned that we need to prioritize our spiritual practice over family work, etc. Can this lead to spiritual bypassing, where we don't take care of our duties and responsibilities? Can't looking after our responsibilities well be part of the spiritual path. Absolutely. And that is kind of the point. The point is precisely that looking after your responsibilities and doing it in the right way. That is a part of the spiritual path. So it is not what we do, but how we do it that makes something spiritual. So it is not even whether you are a monastic or a layperson. It is not about whether you have this kind of job or that kind of job. It is about how you do those things. Do you do it with kindness? Do you do it with a sense of care? Do you do it because you want to create happiness for the people around you? Or are you doing it because you are greedy, because you're angry? This is kind of where the spiritual practice is all about. So with the right attitude, anything can become part of the spiritual practice. In fact, this is exactly what you should be doing. If you don't make your entire life part of the spiritual practice, it's not going to work. This is the only way to live. Everything has to be part of this, because you need that consistency of morality, the consistency of kindness, the consistency of virtue, for that virtue to become the power that you require to enable meditation down the path. So this is a very important point. You have to integrate it with your ordinary life. And that is why I was saying that your ordinary life, or your family life or work life or whatever it is, will benefit from your spiritual practice. It is not as if it's one or the other. The two benefit each other. And that's when you everything kind of improves as a consequence. Okay, very good. So, dear Arjan, in today's afternoon sutta, why are not mother and father included in the list whilst partner and children are? What if one has partner and children already? How do you engage with them when they are subject to all of these aspects of decline? So I suppose that you could include parents in there. I suppose the idea really is that what are you most attached to? And I think what we are tend to be more attached to than our parents is our partner and children. I think that is just how things tend to be normally. We can usually deal with our parents passing away because it's like the natural order of things. But if a partner or a child dies, it's usually very, very traumatic and difficult to deal with. So I think the idea here is just to kind of look at the most important things. But yes, sure, you could add mother and father to that list as well. Because especially if there is strong attachment there, you could certainly do that. Nothing wrong in adding that. But I'm guessing the Buddha is kind of sticking to the most important things, the main things or whatever. So if you have partner and children already, how do you engage with them when they are subject to all of these aspects of decline? Well, how you engage with them is you engage with them with kindness. Because if they are subject to all of these kind of things, then they will suffer, you will suffer, everyone will suffer. Suffering is part of existence. And the more we understand the suffering of others and the suffering of ourselves, the more compassion we have and the more kindness we have towards others. So it doesn't really change anything. But it also means that you become more clear that you want to be independent of the world around you. Because if there is these problems with your partner and children, etc., you don't want to be too attached. You don't want to kind of be too involved, because if you are really, really involved, it's going to be very painful for you when these things happen, when they die or whatever. And the way to be less attached, to be more independent, is precisely to practice the spiritual path. As you practice the spiritual path, you gain the inner sort of inner independence, because you find meaning somewhere else within you rather than finding all the meaning outside. If your entire meaning of your life is with the people around you, you're going to have a big problem when they die or they get old and all of these kind of things. But if you find the meaning within and you have a stability inside of you, it means that you have an independence of the five sense world outside. Yeah, the Buddha talks about taking refuge in the right place. And refuge in the right place, according to the suttas, is in the satipatthanas. The satipatthanas are really about mindfulness of breathing. And if you take refuge in your meditation, refuge in samadhi, it means that you have a lot of strength inside because you are gaining meaning, happiness, purpose, all the important things in life. You're gaining it through your meditation practice. It means that the world outside is no longer so important for you. And because it's less important, you're more independent of the world outside. And this is kind of the purpose of the spiritual practice. It doesn't make you less caring. In fact, it makes you, probably in many ways, more caring because you have a greater ability to see clearly what is beneficial for the people around you. But it makes you more independent. And that is one of the great benefits of spiritual practice. Okay. So, what was the good book on rebirth reincarnation stories you mentioned? That has already been answered. The book is called After, just to remind you. How do we deal with difficult people in a kind and compassionate way without letting them harm us? Okay, so first of all, is to remember that if someone is difficult, and especially if they have many bad qualities, is to remember that this is the way they have been conditioned. And that because they have been conditioned in that way, because this is their habits, because this is how they have been formed, maybe through past lives or through experience in this life, basically they have no choice but to be the way they are. Maybe they can gradually develop out of that, but they are trapped by those past habits. And this is the first thing to understand. And once you understand that other people are trapped by their bad habits, you can start to have compassion for them. But the point is that when you are compassionate and kind to others, it doesn't necessarily have to be the way you act towards them. You don't have to kind of deal with them directly always. What is more important is that you are able to be compassionate. Even if you're compassionate from a distance, from a certain distance, that is already okay. The main thing is your mental attitude towards people. If you're able to deal with them and act towards them with kindness and compassion, that is a bonus. But sometimes, as you say, it is too hard because they might harm you in return. If you think they will harm you, have compassion from a distance instead. Look after yourself. Make sure that you are out of harm's way. Otherwise, it can become very destructive towards you if you're not careful with these things. So be wise and compassionate, not just compassionate in the blind kind of way. And then you are going to be on the right track. It's about looking after people, looking after yourself, and then you are doing the right thing. And then you may find that sometimes you can also act out of compassion. Sometimes an opening may arise, and you know that they're not going to harm you, and then you can also act in the right way as well. But finding the doing this in the right way is important. Okay. Dear Ajahn, how does one find the sweet spot between restlessness and drowsiness when meditating? This is kind of the holy grail of meditation, finding that sweet spot. The answer usually is by enjoying your meditation. If you are drowsy, there are many reasons for being drowsy. One reason is simply that you've been working very hard, you've been using your mind too much, and so you are drowsy. And that is fine. You can't really That drowsiness has to kind of run its course. And once it has run its course, then you can kind of come out of that. And if you're still drowsy after the superficial drowsiness has run its course, that is when you have to use something else to overcome it. The same way with the restlessness of the mind, when you come into a retreat in the beginning, you bring a lot of the habits from your ordinary life, a lot of the thinking, the momentum from ordinary life. It takes a while for that to die down. But once that has died down and you're still restless, well, that is when you have to overcome it using some of the means that the Buddha gives us. And what are those means? One of the most important ways is to enjoy what you are doing, enjoying the meditation, learning to have a positive perception of the people around you, remembering positive aspects of your life. The Buddha calls this chaganusati or silanusati, knowing that you live well and reflecting on that. Yeah, knowing, actually, I live a pretty good life. I'm keeping the five precepts. I tend to be kind and caring for other people. Okay, so you can feel good about yourself. And just that memory, knowing that you live well, can often have a good bring a good feeling with it. Or it can be specific instances in your life, yeah, when you have acted with kindness. Or you are just kind to people around you right now on this retreat. Kindness can also be transmitted without speaking, just through how we act with gentleness and care and these kind of things, even how we think about the people around us. So just that kindness can give rise to a sense of brightness in the mind. And this is the critical thing, to learn to enjoy and to learn to use the mind to give rise to these positive qualities. I mentioned yesterday also the idea of having the Buddha as your teacher. Is a very kind of beautiful thing, beautiful idea. Having a strong Buddhist community right here in Perth, with a strong monastic sangha, with a lay people who are practicing really well. All of these things are very beautiful things. And if you can inspire yourself by thinking about these things, that inspiration is often the thing that you need to overcome both restlessness and also drowsiness. Because if you're inspired, you're not going to be drowsy. If you're inspired, you're also unlikely to be restless, because the mind is enjoying what it is doing. It will stay with the object of meditation as a consequence. So this is really the critical thing, learning to enjoy. And when you're learning to enjoy, that is where these hindrances tend to disappear. Okay, wow, we've done so many questions tonight, that is good. So, dear Ajahn, can you please explain how to do walking meditation? Walking meditation is really all you have to do is to kind of find a piece of ground, like the halls that we have here, or you can go outside or whatever, and you can kind of, and the idea is just to walk back and forth between two points. And the length that you walk is not so important. Ideally, maybe 20 steps is useful at least, so you don't have to turn all the time. And if it is less than that, it might also be okay. But roughly around 20 steps, 25, something like that. And you walk back and forth between two points. That's the idea. And what do you do when you do that? This is kind of the critical thing. And it doesn't really matter so much what you do. You can, in other words, you can do all kinds of things when you do walking meditation. One of the classical ways of doing walking meditation is to watch your feet, the feet touching the ground, feeling your feet as you move, because it is a very kind of obvious sensation when you do walking. So you feel your foot touching the ground, and then the kind of feel the pressure in the foot as you change in the weight from the heel to the toes or whatever, and then you feel the next foot lifting up and moving, being placed on the ground, and you can follow the motion of the feet in this way. And this is one way of doing walking meditation. And if you do this, and your focus is very strong, you can achieve samadhi just by doing walking meditation. There's a story of Ajahn Brahm. He's always been a very exceptional meditator. And he tells a story of when he was doing walking meditation in the hall at Wat Nanachat. This is the International Forest Monastery here in Ubon, where many of the monks who were disciples of Ajahn Chah, that's where they stayed. It was like an international forest monastery here. And Ajahn Brahm said the concrete on the floor in that meditation hall was the worst kind of concrete that you would have ever seen. It was kind of really kind of bumpy and terrible. Why was it so bad? Because it had been poured by the local villagers, and they didn't know anything about concrete pouring, right? They were just doing it to help out the monastery. They weren't professional concrete workers or anything like that. The local villagers that did this, and they kind of did their best, but it was very, very bumpy. It was like kind of it wasn't very impressive the way they had done the concrete, according to Ajahn Brahm. And then Ajahn Brahm would do walking meditation in this hall, and this concrete that he saw, which was kind of really bumpy or whatever, and he would get this beautiful lights coming out of that concrete. The more focused he became, the more powerful his samadhi became, the more beautiful that concrete appeared, until there was all these sparkling lights and all these kind of things. The concrete appeared like this kaleidoscope of something very fantastic and beautiful. And the downside of that, the downside of Ajahn Brahm finding concrete so beautiful, is that now he wants concrete everywhere. So the monastery at Bodhinyana Monastery, we have the most concrete of any monastery in the world. There's concrete roads going this way and that way. And whenever you ask Ajahn Brahm, well, what should we do with this road? Ajahn Brahm always says, concrete that road. That's kind of Ajahn Brahm's default answer to what we should do with these roads. So this is what happens when you walk in meditation. It's really powerful. You see beauty in anything. And this is kind of the what happens. So this is the samadhi aspect, or the samatha aspect of walking meditation. I am not sure if I would necessarily recommend that. You can try that. But sometimes when you sit down and you're kind of trying to calm the mind in sitting meditation, sometimes it's good to do something else when you do walking meditation, because the mind can only deal with so much calming. There comes a point when the mind gets rebellious and it wants to do something else. So I would recommend doing something else when you do walking meditation. And so what should you do? And what you can do is you can do some contemplations. You can contemplate the content of the suttas. You can contemplate, like we're talking today, about old age and death and these kind of things. And you can reflect on that and see how it applies to you. This is a nice way of using the walking meditation, just to do a bit of contemplation. Because that contemplation, we can then bring it back afterwards into your sitting meditation, and it will enhance your ability to attain samadhi and peace later on. You can also use the walking meditation to do metta practice, loving kindness practice. There's a bit of movement of the mind when you do metta. You're kind of spreading the metta to the whole world. You can do that while you're doing walking meditation as well. You can do walking meditation. You can do nothing specific at all. You can just walk back and forth and just enjoy the peace, enjoy the good company. Watch your mind, get to know yourself, get to understand your defilements, what the problems really are. And then when you see the defilements, then you can apply countermeasures to overcome them. You can understand that actually this person, I find this person a bit difficult. And when you know that you find a person a bit difficult, then you can use the idea of compassion and metta to overcome that difficulty, using the idea that I talked about before. So the walking meditation is very diverse. And when you read the suttas, the suttas say, they say that the Buddha or the monks, they would walk back and forth. That's all it says. It doesn't say what they're doing when they walk back and forth. It just says they're walking back and forth. What they did not do was watching the breath. Watching the breath is not done when you do walking meditation. But they're just walking back and forth. And that is really all. And the rest really is up to us to decide. So do whatever you find useful. Any of these things I have mentioned or anything else as well can be done during walking meditation. All right, so we have come to the last questions for this evening. And it is as follows. Dear Ajahn, how to deal with sloth and torpor? Thank you. In other words, sloth and torpor is the old translation for tinna midda in Pali, which now these days is often rendered maybe as a tiredness and lethargy or something like that. And how do you deal with it? Well, first of all, don't fight it, because if you try to fight it, you usually make the mind even more tired and you're going to fall even faster asleep. So if you find that you fall asleep and you start snoring here, right here in the meditation hall, that is okay. If you snore, we will have compassion for you. We will say, okay, this person, wow, they're really relaxing and enjoying the time here in the meditation hall. And that, I think, is the right response to kind of snoring. So don't be afraid. Just relax. Just enjoy whatever, you know. Just don't try to fight the tiredness. It usually makes it worse. Some of the time, what you will find is that the tiredness that you have is just what you have brought with you from your ordinary life. And then once you overcome that, suddenly you find your mind brightening up. I always like the story of one of my fellow monastics who tells me that every time he sits down, he starts off by nodding, yeah, every single time. And it doesn't take long, however, before his mind clears up, and then his meditation actually is quite powerful after that. So sometimes you just need to get rid of that superficial tiredness, and then the meditation is okay. Sometimes that does not work. Sometimes the tiredness carries on. There could be many reasons for that. One of the reasons is not enough happiness in the mind. And then again, you need to inspire the mind. You need to bring some positive feeling into the mind. And when you get those positive feelings in the mind brightens up. And the tiredness and lethargy is kind of evaporates like the dew before the sun. Yeah, bang, it's gone. And then you are bright and clear, and the meditation works really well. So this is the idea. Don't fight it. Instead, use the wisdom. Use the basic ideas of the Buddha on how to bring the brightness into the mind. And then you're going to be on the right track. Okay, everyone, that is all for tonight. So let's just do the Arahang Samma Sambuddho together. And then I wish you all a good night's rest. And we'll see you again tomorrow morning here.